Green Dream, a podcast about ethical investing for positive impact and a better future. Join me, James Baird, as I interview fund managers, advisors, and a range of leaders in sustainability about topical environmental, social, and governance issues. We look forward to joining you on your ethical investment journey. Feels good to create positive impact. Hello and welcome to our special Ethical Investment Week podcast. The theme for Ethical Investment Week 2021 is wayfinding for ethical investment. In its simplest definition, wayfinding is about observing the natural world in order to work out your location, orient yourself towards your destination, set a course to get you there, then dynamically respond to signs as you journey. Wayfinding is as relevant for our times as it has been throughout history. By drawing upon ancient wisdom, modern wayfinders hold insights that can make a big difference for ethical investors and a sustainable future. On that basis, who better to talk to about rich Aboriginal cultural traditions than Cato Muir? Cato is the chair of the First Nations Heritage Protection Alliance and the National Native Title Council. He is an Ngalia traditional owner and a Wati, a Goldfields Aboriginal cultural and community leader, and an anthropologist, archaeologist, with many years' experience working in Aboriginal heritage, language preservation and maintenance, traditional ecological education and native title research. Cato also operates a number of businesses, including an Aboriginal art business, a sandalwood company and a heritage consultancy business. He's a long-time activist for bilingual and two-way education, environmental and cultural heritage protection, and promoting alternative community-based enterprises, especially through his PhD university partnerships for research on wealth in First Nations. On the 24th of May in 2020, Rio Tinto destroyed a site that represented 46,000 years worth of culture and history for the Puutu Kunti Kurrama and Pinikura peoples of the Pilbara in Western Australia. That's PKKP for short. The blast devastated a place of personal, community, national and international significance. People around the globe responded with shock and outrage. In talking to Cato, there's so much more to the story than this incident. Perhaps it's just the straw that broke the camel's back, but we have so much work to do to understand cultural heritage protection. What is free, prior and informed consent? What do we know about these sites that we're destroying? I learned a lot from Cato and I couldn't let him go without giving us a Dreamtime story, so make sure you stick around to the end for that. I hope you enjoy this special Ethical Investment Week podcast. Cato, thanks so much for your time today. I know you're a busy man. You've got so many things on the go. Firstly, I'd like to acknowledge the traditional custodians of the land that I'm meeting on, the Wardandi Noongar people. We pay our respects to them and their cultures and to elders both past and present. You're at home in Leonora, right?
Yes. Thanks, James, for the introduction. And I'm in Leonora, which is generally, I think we all identify as Wangada peoples. Among the Wangada people, we've got about 15 distinct languages, but my language is Ngalia, generally speaking, we identify as Wangada in this part of the world.
And so that's basically the desert country north of Kalgoorlie?
It is desert. It's on the edge of between... So technically speaking, I mean, Leonora's on the Greenstone Belt, which is where a lot of the gold mines and nickel mines are. And it's part of the Murchison bioregion, but we're effectively on the edge of the Great Victoria Desert and the Murchison bioregion. So between here and Laverton is the transition zone. So it's interesting because a lot of the towns through here on that Greenstone Belt, which is essentially exposed hills and rocks, but surrounded by sand and desert.
Right, and you're pretty familiar with mining companies out that way as well.
The
engine room of the WA economy.
Yes. Well, it's been, I mean, Leonora was founded as a gold mine, and it continues. The Sons of Gwalia mine has been operating since the beginning of the 1900s, and is still going strong today.
I wanted to start by asking you about Juukan Gorge. Globally, it's had a massive impact for Rio Tinto. It really has been the straw that broke the camel's back in relation to this type of environmental incident. In particular, you've been talking about the relevance to how people did live 40 to 45,000 years ago and what we know about them and perhaps what we don't know yet about their way of life and where we're just currently learning about.
Well, I mean, there are two concurrent knowledge systems at play. One is the traditional Aboriginal knowledge system, which is grounded in the dreaming. In my language, it's called Tjokurpa. And that's that's the laws, that's the histories, the knowledge, the precedents for enactment of laws, the reality, all of that stuff is captured within the Tjokurpa. And then, of course, we're interacting and engaging with Western knowledge systems, which primarily the interface with Aboriginal people in the modern context, we've got a lot of legal interfaces through native title laws and stuff like that. But that's informed by anthropologists and archaeologists. So anthropology informs the Western systems around the living cultures, and archaeology informs Western knowledge through the deep history. And both of these disciplines continue to discover new insights. And in particular, the archaeologists, as recently as this year, about a couple of months back, published a paper around the idea of the superhighways that resulted in the settling of Australia by Aboriginal people, within about 80,000 from about 80,000 years ago. And I mean, that's a key point of differentiation between Aboriginal people and Western science, is that Aboriginal people say, no, well, we never come from anywhere else. We've been here all the time. Western science is fixated on the out of Africa theory, and therefore all humans in their way of looking at the world came out of Africa at one point in the past. And what they're finding is that Australian Aboriginal people are one of the earliest populations of humans who have, air quotes, come out of Africa and now inhabit an area of land or another continent. So the science today is sort of suggesting there's a few things coming out of this new bit of research that's coming out. One is the movement of people. So they say that Aboriginal people entered into Australia either through New Guinea or through the Kimberley, keeping in mind that New Guinea and Australia were at one point a single landmass, which archaeologists call Sahul. And even today, the highland people in New Guinea have genetic sort of connections to Australian Aboriginal people. And the theory was that they'd come in at either one of these contact points, and within about 6,000 years had settled all of Australia. And what the archaeologists have been able to reconstruct through more through maths than anything else, but also correlating with archaeological sites, are the highways that people used. And that then comes back to Jugun. Jugun's one of those focal points of telling the story of that original movement of people and the occupation of Australia 45,000 years ago. Other things to keep in mind, and this is stuff that's relevant today in debates around climate change and resource extraction and all these sort of things, is that Aboriginal people have experienced, in terms of epochs, there was the shift from the Pleistocene period into the Holocene period, which occurred about 20,000 years ago. So we've gone through and lived through a lot of these momentous climate change events, which we still carry in our oral history. We carry the stories, we carry the adaptions, the survival. And so in our, you know, the patrimony or the wealth of our nations, we actually do have knowledge that is only really becoming apparent to Western scientific thought today. So I suppose that's a complicated way of coming to that point of, you know, acknowledging that there are different places in Australia that Aboriginal people have called home for multiple thousands of years, and a lot of that's being correlated back through archaeology, and archaeology not only of, you know, the physical, but also an analysis of, you know, mathematical analysis of statistics and numbers. There's theories that they use to sort of correlate these patterns.
And I guess when we talk about climate change, we think, okay, man-made climate change, it's happening now at a rapid pace. But you're really talking there about just understanding what changes in climate have happened in over the thousands of years and how it's affected people's regional movements, their lifestyles, probably their diets, you know, their entire way of life. That really, as you say, we're only just learning about that now, aren't we?
Yeah. No, we're only just learning about it now. But I'll just give you some examples. I mean, you're in Wurundjeri Noongar country. One of the opening sort of comments that Noongars would use when they were telling stories. So similarly in English, you would say once upon a time. Noongars would say in the Nyiring, and the Nyiring is the cold times, which we take to represent the last ice age. So that's just a direct sort of connection between a lot of the origin stories that they reference and refer to. A lot of these archaeological sites like Tjukan, the Burrup Peninsula, and because the Burrup Peninsula, it's in the ocean today, but 40,000 years ago, it was a highland 40 kilometres inland. A lot of those places became, during the Ice Age, for instance, a refuge for people who retreated from... Because effectively in Australia, what the Ice Age represented was a period of time when all the water sort of dried up. It became very cold and there were constant winds that were blowing. And a lot of those winds actually created the sand dunes, which are now a significant feature in the Australian deserts. And there's a nice little pattern you see there where on the western side of Australia, the sand dunes travel in an east-west direction. That's how they lay. In the Simpson Desert, sand dunes are in a north-south direction, and that sort of correlates with the movement of the winds across Australia. Out in the Nullarbor Plains, which are just, you know, in the Goldfields region, there are occupation sites when people had found it more convenient to occupy the caves in the extensive cave systems under the Nullarbor Plains. So there's still, you know, fireplaces that are 10,000 years old and they still look fresh today. So in that whole history of Australia, the deep history of Australian Aboriginal society, there's some really telling and amazing sort of stories out there. One of the points I will make, during that Ice Age period, they moved into these resource areas, and then once the Ice Age ended and we came into what we have today is the modern climate, which is about 5,000 years old, you can see the shift in the technologies, the stone tools that are left behind. And so seed harvesting and milling became a major activity, economic activity. And so across Australia, you'll find grinding grooves or grinding stones that represent that adaptation to the new environment and the use of these technologies to support that way of life.
It is getting a bit more widely acknowledged that this idea of a hunter-gatherer, and I guess the stereotypical image of a hunter-gatherer that we've all got, is just totally incorrect, and that the potential lifestyle was abundant, prosperous, and the use of farming techniques, not as we know it in Western terms, but or European culture, but in terms of really living off the land and in trend with the seasons, and books like Stone Age Economics and Dark Emio to discuss that in detail. Do we need to be just continuing sort of the myth busting on this sort of stuff?
Oh yeah, totally. I think it goes back to imperialistic biases that are ingrained in Eurocentric perspectives. And of course, I mean, Europeans are making ambit claims as well, because they did not invent agriculture, and indeed most Europeans were still living in semi-nomadic sort of lifestyles about 4,000 or 5,000 years ago. I'll just give you a couple of little myth bustings. So one is, you're not civilized if you haven't invented the wheel. And that's an accusation that people lay at Aboriginal people. And our response would be, well, why? Why would you invent the wheel? If you made a cart, what animal will drag the cart? I can't see a kangaroo pulling a cart. So, you know,
there's that. A bit that, bouncy.
Yeah, and then, of course, the immediate response is, well, sure, we didn't invent the wheel, but we invented an aerodynamic tool which is now underwriting a lot of the modern aeronautical you know, approaches. So there's that. And then, of course, the other one, which is only really, you know, I was in a meeting yesterday with the chair of BHP, and just wanting to reinforce the value, I suppose, of Aboriginal cultural heritage. One of the major technological achievements or breakthroughs that we've had is the construction of fish traps. And right across Australia, you will find fish traps in operation. Some of these fish traps are dated at, 40,000 years back to about, 10,000 years. And the phenomenal thing about this, when you stop and pause and think about it, if you put an engineering hat on and an economics hat on, these are engineering marvels, using the environment and using raw materials. They continue to be structurally sound today, so they're still operating, and they're still delivering economic returns. So a piece of infrastructure investment that some of our ancestors invested in 40,000 years ago continues to deliver a economic return into the present. You start doing the maths on that, and that represents a major, massive return on investment that modern infrastructure just would never live up to. And that's the level at which the Aboriginal economics operates, is that, and this is one of the criticisms, I suppose, of Dark Emu, is that it's trying to challenge accepted theories by saying Aboriginal people were farmers. And that's pandering to that inbuilt bias that modern civilization is, you're not civilized if you're not farming. I'm looking at it through a hunter-gatherer lens, and I'm going, well, or farming's not environmentally sound. It devastates landscapes. It actually, in the long term, and, you know, we're only talking 5,000 years that farming's been around, you result in modified landscapes that are often reduced in productivity. Keeping in mind that farming also emerged in the highlands of Papua New Guinea about 10,000 years ago as well, at the same time as it emerged in, you know, I think it's the Hindus and the Middle East. But that sort of bias towards farming away from hunting and gathering, because hunting and gathering in this life that we're going into, where we're looking at energy efficiency, relationships with nature and environment, and then, of course, the human body and our consumption. So a lot of us today are consuming toxics, we're consuming unhealthy foods and all of that sort of stuff. In the hunter-gatherer way of life, the pursuit was essentially spiritual, intellectual pursuits, and that's where a lot of the ceremonies, the dreaming, all those sort of cultural vibrancy emerged, which continues today in the living traditions, but also in rock art, in these feats of engineering. I mean, the biggest one that's, I think, getting world attention today is in Victoria. I think they call it Bumbidge or something like that, which are basically an aquaculture system that was designed to manage the flow of water and also eel production of eels. So a lot of our interactions with nature is place-based, but also at a macro level. So burning, which is now becoming a recognized form of carbon sequestration, is actually a macro level engagement with the environment and the forces of, you know, weather patterns, which then contribute to replenishing and renewing the productive capacity of the land. So those sort of things are, you know, these are insights that Aboriginal people carry and hold, which at one point in the future, when there's a collapse based on the resource extractive model that's been pursued aggressively, and I think the bushfires recently strike that point back home, is that if you're not managing the land in the way that Aboriginal people have done, then you're heading down towards a apocalyptic sort of future.
Yeah, we talk about sustainability in the investment world on a daily basis with the sort of area that we work in, but it seems what we're talking about here is sustainability in the truest sense, as in how can we allow the ecological system to sustain itself over not just decades or hundreds of years, but really thousands of years.
Mm.
And as I say, we've lost sight of a bit of that, but we're probably having to relearn or learn for the first time how that was done. And it's so interesting that you mentioned you just met with BHP, because Juukan and Gorge is obviously a Rio Tinto issue that made those global headlines. But over many, many years, you've basically been working as an activist in the area of resources, and including uranium as well, and talking about this idea of social license versus legal license. So again, the area that we work in pretty closely is the area of social license. And so in a sense, we're not just talking about Rio Tinto here, are we?
No. We're talking about fundamental human rights values. And you know, the values and the principles of human rights apply to anyone who's human. And unfortunately, we have a lot of time an energy invested by vested interests, whether that be people seeking short-term returns on capital, or people in who are vested in ensuring that others seek that, and in the process they make the rules. And so the principles here is that human rights apply to everyone. Unfortunately, for Indigenous peoples, we've actually had to push it even further to say, well, human rights for Indigenous people, you know, we need to come up with these, you know, the Declaration of Rights of Indigenous Peoples, which is really repeating the message of the Universal Declaration of Human Rights, but making it more grounded so that the corporates, the governments are aware that human rights also apply to Indigenous peoples. You know, there's a consequence of the marginalisation, dispossession and suppression that a lot of Indigenous peoples endure. So social licence needs to be fully aware of and cognizant of human rights, and then measure how human rights are preserved, protected or impacted. And often, you know, you can't always rely on government as the final say, or the arbiter, or you know, the yardstick on measuring the impact of human rights. Governments are, you know, often, and you know, it's no secret, Western Australia, the government is actually trapped or beholden to the resources sector. It effectively does its bidding, and in a blinkered way. So my role as an activist, and I'm assuming your role and your listeners' role as responsible investors, our role is to say, well, there are other ways of generating a return on capital invested, or generating a return from an asset that's established. And it can be done in a way that does not do damage to people, society, environment, and it does it in a way that actually promotes and encourages and celebrates human rights values and principles. So that's, I suppose, the effect there. So not all laws are conducive to celebrating, you know, Aboriginal culture or celebrating human rights. And it's incumbent on people who recognise that and understand that, and you know, want to create a society that we all feel comfortable living in, that is, you know, practicing diversity, that's celebrating cultural values, all those sort of things. So that's essentially the motivation, I suppose, behind methods of activism. And it's not saying that people in government or CEOs of corporates are not also seeking that, but it's just a process of a conversation, I suppose, or a dialogue to strike a balance. And often the balance is too far in one spectrum, and then people lose, or people suffer, or environment, the planet suffers. Yeah.
And that ties into this idea of wealth. And you've said that a signature can be worth $1 billion, which is sounds like a little bit of pressure for that person holding the pen. But this idea of wealth, again, of maybe not just in terms of dollars.
Yeah, yeah. Well, it's one of those things. I'm hazarding a guess that a lot of people in the financial sector haven't really stopped to think about what wealth is. The common approach or the common assessment is around this idea of what is it, the flow of wealth. So GDP is measured as a flow, not as a stock. And there's a reemergence of people who are starting to think about the stock of wealth. But everything's measured on, you know, flow of money or resources between a, you know, in a 12-month cycle and multiples of 12-month cycles, which are probably 3 years being the most extreme that you plan out. So the wealth, and this got me thinking about First Nations wealth. And First Nations, we, you know, as Aboriginal people in Australia or Native Americans or people living on the islands in the Pacific, Melanesia, places like that, anywhere where people have this relationship, and I think that's the thing, it's a relationship with the environment, with the land, and with each other. And these relationships can be broken around through spiritual lenses or various different lenses. End of the day, everyone is engaged in a activity to deliver for their needs. And the best analogy I see is a spider on a golden orb weaver spider during the lead up to the full moon. And the spider would build these massive webs. And these webs would then be a company, I suppose, if you look at it that way. It's their infrastructure to harvest and take resources. And the resources they're looking at are bugs essentially flying from the Earth up to the moon. And in that process, they get caught in the web. So, you know, the economic models are all there. It's in nature, but it's a question of whether you produce for meeting immediate needs or whether you produce to meet a surplus or generate a surplus. And that's been the origins of a lot of this stuff. But the surplus then becomes the final result, because you're generating the surplus, and often the surplus is not consumed, and that then generates a unsustainable economic model, which continues to feed in itself until exhaustion. And so the wealth of nations, or wealth of First Nations, is essentially our infrastructure, whether it's the reciprocity system. So we call that Ngabidiga, or Ngabidi Ngabidi is one of the terms. In the Kimberley and into the Northern Territory, there are parts that they call it the Wunan system. These systems, Ngabidi, range from trade right through to payback. And it can occur anywhere in between. But it's also, you know, the mining, for instance, the resource extraction industry. We in Australia, Aboriginal people, have been mining for over 20,000 years. Some of our, the Wilgie Mia mine site in the Murchison region is a red ochre mine, an ochre mine that's 20,000 years old. In the extraction of that resource, we also deliver or provide something of value in exchange. So that's the Ngabidi system. This is where there's a breakdown, though, in the current economic model, which is continually extracting but never really replacing. And that's where, questions around sustainability and all those sort of things start to emerge. So you know, the comments I've got there is we do have models, we do have our institutions that generate wealth. What's going on, though, is that we're competing against a system that's unsustainable, but it's constantly moving. So if you look at the flow of capital, which really commenced in a big way with the European imperialism as it extended across the globe, the whole purpose of that was to take wealth from other places and deliver it back to Europe. So most Europeans today live in a bubble that's created by a process of exploitation and extraction from other parts of the world without a commensurate exchange. And so we're probably living in that era now where some of those debts are coming back to be repaid. And, you know, that that's one of the things. And you asked about Adam Smith's The Wealth of Nations. I see that as the manual, the standard operating procedures. Yeah, the standard operating procedures for European imperialism in its extraction of resources. How do you set up your organize each part of your society to be able to engage in that activity? So there's at some point in the future, we will have to challenge the way in which that standard operating procedure has been developed. And I think that's happening now as you see the emergence of carbonomics, you see the flow of green capital and, you know, the Hague ruling with Dutch Royal Shell. Each one of those is basic, and of course the participation of a lot of Indigenous people in the carbon economy, where we're basically around the world, Indigenous people control 80% of the intact ecosystems. There's a opportunity there at some point, and this is where it's incumbent on us as Indigenous peoples to self-organise, to be able to engage and interact with the pirates who command capital. But it's also incumbent on people like your listeners and yourselves, who are part of that responsible investment fraternity, to basically say, well, you know, handle with care. We're going to merge into a new arena of interaction, wealth generation in land and territory. But let's get it right from the outset. And that's where the ESG principles come in, the environmental, social and governance. Those principles come in alongside sustainable and, you know, or responsible investment practices. So that's an emerging field which will have a, you know, it's beyond government. It's beyond a lot of corporates in their own right. And a lot of it actually then, you know, the narrative or the empowerment that we need to do is to go back and empower consumers, because consumers are driving a lot of this. The, you know, we've got COP 26 or something coming up in Glasgow later this year. The entire environmental movement, which is people, aka consumers, have driven this this response that's then filtered back through the corporate sector and then into not nation states, but it's you know, going up into the United Nations level, which will then filter back into nation states. So there's that, it's that constant negotiation and dialogue between actors and parties around both an emerging opportunity, emerging threat, which is the climate change, and then a consideration, I suppose, of who has the suitable answers and who can actually put into practice measures to address this or ameliorate the threat.
You've got such a wealth of knowledge in these areas, Cato, and I just feel like we're really scratching the surface here. So hopefully we can learn more from you over time, and I will certainly provide links to your LinkedIn page, to your website, and we just look forward to hearing you discuss these topics more in future. Can I just go back to a bit of a campfire story that you've talked about, how the echidna and thorny devil got their spikes? Can you just, as a bit of a wrap-up, tell us that story?
It's a really interesting story. I mean, it's a small story in the scheme of things, but it actually addresses all these massive, and this is how Dreamtime Story works. And I think the Grimm fairy tales were similar in their origins, but this story basically looks at the biological attributes of these particular animals. It looks at the environment that they operate, you know, the ecosystem that they live in, but also the lessons from that story go into our rules around social engagement and social interactions, and the consequences for transgressing these laws. So the echidna, everyone knows, which is, you know, porcupine or echidna. The mountain devil is a little lizard, which is scientifically known as Moloch horridus, I think it's Moloch horridus. And in the dreaming, these two were persons that ate ants, and they had ant breath, basically, which not many people enjoyed their company or being around. And eventually they discovered each other and found their passion for eating ants together. And over time they fell in love. Now, the problem was that a relationship between them was illegal according to our what we call the skin systems, or Nyami. And the skin system is one of our foundational institutions in our society that regulate our relationships with everyone, whether it's people, the universe, the animals. It's a foundational element of our society. So this story is the moral of what happens if you offend against that particular law. And so, cutting a long story short, they escaped, ran away. Their family and friends were mortally offended by this transgression, so, and the only possible outcome or punishment was by death. So they pursued. And in their pursuit, there are things that point to the biological features of the echidna, for instance. In the way its footsteps, the tracks it leaves behind, the toes point backwards. So when you're hunting an echidna and you find their tracks on the ground, you don't follow the direction of the toes like you do with anything else. You've got to go backwards. That's one of the techniques that the echidna in the Dreamtime used to conceal his tracks. So that's the way in which these lessons are wrapped up in these stories. And, of course, the final outcome was that they were captured by the pursuers and punished unto death. The man was speared all over, and the echidna's quills are the evidence of those spears, or the actual manifestation of those spears. The mountain devil also has... it's sort of got chameleon-like qualities, so that was to blend into the environment, to hide away. When she was captured, she was also speared, and the women whacked her on the back of the head with the fighting sticks, and so on the back of the mountain devil you've got this big lump of fat, I think it is, with spikes on it. And that so when they killed them, they basically put them aside, and then they turned them into these two animals, the echidna and the mountain devil. So it's a really interesting story told to me when I was a kid. But over time, we sort of, you can review and understand that story and look at where it links into the landscape. There's one place, for instance, where they visited and travelled in the dreaming tracks, and you go to this waterhole, and you see that the rocks itself capture the water by flowing. When it rains, the water flows through all these rocks and crevices down to the actual waterhole itself. That's a natural feature in the land. It is connected with the mountain devil story. When you go, you know, biologists have identified that when a mountain devil drinks water, it goes up to grass with dew on it in the mornings and capture the drops of those that dew on its skin, and through capillary action move the water, I think it's to the mouth, or just absorbs it in that process. So that's the life lesson, the biological lesson written into the land through the lens of these Dreamtime stories.
I actually did pick up one years ago that was next to a highway up north, and for something so spiky, I was actually surprised how soft it was. So maybe it links into that water absorption through the skin there. But thank you for sharing that story. To me, it's a Romeo and Juliet style story of unrequited love that predates Shakespeare's version by a few thousand years at least. So yeah, really, really interesting to share this story from your childhood. And as I say, it'd be great to hear more of those stories, but in the interest of time, we'll have to leave that to a later date. So really appreciate your time today.
No worries, James. Yeah, I value the opportunity to share these thoughts and insights, and hopefully, you know, we can all sort of go on that journey of creating a better world.
Great. Thank you.
All right. Thanks, man.
Thanks for listening to the Green Dream Podcast. For information on the ways that we can help you on your ethical investment journey, visit www.justinvest.net.au. Please keep in mind that the information contained in this podcast is of a general nature and does not take into account your personal circumstances. Past performance is not a reliable indicator of future results. You should consider obtaining personalised professional advice from a licensed financial planner before implementing any significant financial decisions. In the spirit of reconciliation, the Green Dream acknowledges the traditional custodians of country throughout Australia and their connections to land, sea and community. We pay our respects to their elders past, present and emerging, and extend that respect to all Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people.